Guzman against Sheehan. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Robert Patterson for Ruben Guzman. We're here, Your Honors, because the magistrate judge granted summary judgment, finding there were no disputed questions of fact in this 1983 case. If I were to stand here before you absolutely silent for 3 to 7 minutes, the time would weigh heavy on our hands. It's a long time for someone to be chasing Ruben Guzman around the day room and beating him. Our claim against Sandra White, the correctional officer, is that she did not properly, adequately, in any respect, try to intervene to prevent this attack. And our claim is not that she should have known something before the attack and made a prevention of it. That's what the state or the county keeps thinking we're claiming. Our claim is a failure to intervene claim. And that means that once she knows the serious harm is threatened to Ruben Guzman because Willis Reese is beating on him, she has to take reasonable steps under the Farmer guidelines to intervene and protect him and give him the constitutional protection that he's entitled to have. There are disputed factual questions about what happened at that time, which I've listed in the two briefs. And among those is, did she leave her post? Did she exercise any oral commands to gain control of the situation? She's trained to do that. That's perhaps the most effective way she could have acted, but she did not do it under the evidence. Ruben's testimony is that he saw her talk on a radio and she left the interlock. We submit that a jury could well find that that is deliberate disregard. She knew there was a threat of serious harm to Ruben Guzman, and instead of taking the very easy step of calling through the steel mesh that is in that door and exercising her authority as she's supposed to do and say, stop, knock it off, exercise the command to try to get this thing to stop. She did not do that, and she agrees she did not do that because she claims that the door was a thick glass through which no one could hear her, and she would not exercise that kind of a command. She claims she beat on the glass. Ruben denies that and that she did not do that. She claims that she did say something in the interlock about trying to stop it, but she also tells us that no one could hear her inside because of the steel glass, which the evidence proves absolutely was not there. It was a steel mesh that the officers always used to convey commands to the inmates. So here we have a period of time, and that's disputed. Sandra White says to us that this lasted 30 to 60 seconds. But Ruben Guzman tells us that it was 3 or 5 to 7 minutes, and that's a long time. There was a hiatus in the middle that I think both sides agree on of 15 to 20 seconds, where Ruben was chased partway across the room and then desisted for 15 to 20 seconds. Sandra White did not exercise any authority at that point, according to the evidence. In fact, there's evidence that she may not have even been there. So she did not perform the very, very simple, basic act of trying to intervene to protect Ruben. And there are cases that we've cited, Your Honors, from this circuit, also from around the country, that say when a correctional officer has the opportunity to intervene in a simple way without threat to that officer and does not do it, that can rise to the level of conscious disregard. And that's all we're asking. We're not saying that a jury or even Judge Ashman would say, oh, yes, you win. We're saying that we have the opportunity to present that to the jury. And that's the basis of our claim against Sandra White.
Is there any dispute, Mr. Patterson, about what call she made?
No, we believe that she called for help because Sergeant Hicks said that he got a call for help and he responded. He wasn't sure how rapidly he got there, but he did do it. So I cannot say to the court that she didn't call for help. She did that.
And there's no indication of the time you say that response occurred?
Well, there is indication in two respects. Mr. Guzman says that it took 5 to 7 minutes. And then, of course, Sandra White says, no, it took only a few seconds. And at one point, Sergeant Hicks said he thought he got there within 90 seconds. But then at another point, he said he did not know how long it took him to get there or where he came from. So these are disputed factual questions that we think the jury should hear and then decide whether or not this was conscious disregard or deliberate disregard on Sandra White's part. The other aspect, which is entirely independent, is our claim against the Sheriff of Cook County and really against two of his officers, and that is Superintendent Brown and Lieutenant Mayweather. We submit to the court that it is conscious disregard under Monell to maintain a custom and practice for such a long period of time of completely inadequately reclassifying prisoners at the Cook County Jail. They know, in fact, they set up the program for the very purpose of separating violent inmates from nonviolent inmates to protect the less violent or the nonviolent. There is no dispute here about whether or not putting the violent in with the nonviolent is a good penal practice. They intend to do it. But they do it so badly, so repeatedly, on a daily basis, and they know that's happening because they don't get through this reclassification list ever. They have a 60-day requirement where they must do it under state law and their own procedures. And Lieutenant Mayweather testifies that on every single...
What does state law say?
State administrative code says every 60 days you must reclassify every prisoner. And so their county policy is congruent with state law. The problem is, on a daily basis, they know they don't do it. They get down as far as they can go, and then they stop, because the next day, instead of carrying on with the list, they start at the top again with whoever is up for that 60-day rotation. And so for Mr. Reese, that happened three times.
What evidence is there in the record that this is a chronic problem as opposed to a problem that occurred on this particular day or on this particular cell block?
Because Lieutenant Mayweather says that on every single day they don't get to the bottom of the list and they go to the next list on the next day. He had been in charge of this unit. He had been moved in there in 2001 or 2002 by his testimony. It had always been the same way.
And what evidence is there in the record that this chronic neglect or chronic, whatever we want to term it, was something known to the sheriff?
Not to Sheriff Sheehan himself, there is none. And as far as a claim against the sheriff himself, I said in one of our footnotes that we can't show that Sheriff Sheehan knew about this behavior. We can show that Superintendent Brown knew about it or should have known, you know, inferentially
and
knew about it.
Superintendent Brown is superior to or subordinate to the sheriff?
Subordinate to the sheriff and the immediate superior of Lieutenant Mayweather.
I see. And what is his basic responsibility, the superintendent?
To ensure that, among
no,
other...
No, I'm seeing it. What does he oversee? How much of the...
Superintendent Brown oversaw all of Division 5, which included the classification and reclassification procedures that Lieutenant Mayweather performed under his supervision.
For Division 5?
Yes.
I see. How many divisions are there in the county jail?
I think they go up to about 11 or 13 of them.
I see.
Right. That's my helpful. Time has expired.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Mr. Grow.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paul Grow. On behalf of the appellees in this matter, and I'm here to ask this court, this panel this morning, to affirm the judgment of the district court in this matter as to all defendants. Initially, as to Officer Sandra White, who was being sued in her individual capacity, while it may be true, as counsel has alleged, that she may not have done everything that she could have done, she did the best thing. She called for help. She called the cavalry to come and show up to help out when the fight started, which by all accounts, by all the testimony of all the parties, of all accounts, the help they got there in a very short period of time. Had she not called for help, no help would have come at all. So, although counsel takes issue with the lower court's decision regarding items like did the fight last 60 seconds, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, 3 minutes? Did it take 3 minutes to get there, 4 minutes to get there? Could Sandra White have yelled through the mesh cage, which was a part of the door at that time? The interlock window that she was sitting in was solid glass.
Where was the mesh?
The door at that time was a combination steel door on the bottom, and the top half of the door was like a wired steel mesh door.
And this is the door between the prisoners and the interlock?
This is the door that leads from the interlock room where the officer Sandra White sits in, to the day room area.
Where the prisoners were?
Correct, where the 70, 80 detainees were at and where the fight took place.
So there's a huge dispute about whether it's glass or mesh. Nobody wins, am I right?
I believe the record is clear that the window that the officer sits in is solid glass.
Why couldn't she have yelled at them through the mesh at the door?
Well, she could have, but that's not an issue of material fact.
Why?
Because she did the best thing that she could have done. She got on a radio and called and used Motorola to get help.
My understanding of the plaintiff's case is he thinks she should have done both, and indeed that was required to do both by the standard operating procedure. Is that correct?
It's one option that a correction officer has to choose at their disposal.
Is there a written standard operating procedure in the record?
There is not. The record is full of testimony from many people who testify that one of the options that a correctional officer, a tier officer, has at his or her disposal is to give a verbal command. And she could have given a verbal command
in addition to calling. So it's one of the options.
It is.
That's how the testimony reads.
Yes.
It's not mandatory.
No. I believe that's how the testimony is with regard to all the parties.
And what did the officer do when she apparently did leave the room, or according to the testimony of the plaintiff, at least?
Our position is that she didn't leave, but the court took all the facts, obviously in the appellant's favor. But whether she left for 2 or 3 minutes to get help, or whether she decided to yell through a verbal command through a mesh door, the fact of the matter is she did the very best thing that she could have done, and that is to call immediately for backup help, which the record indicates from all parties arrived there very, very quickly. When backup help did arrive, the other officers secured the plaintiff off the floor. He was taken for medical treatment and thereafter taken to hospitalization, where he was given proper care. I would submit in this case that there was no deliberate indifference on her part. If anything, she showed deliberate care.
So your argument is that we ought to take the facts, or take the situation and assess it as a whole to determine if there was deliberate indifference. Am I right?
I would say that all of the alternatives that she could have done, if you're saying could she have gone into the day room where there's 70 to 80 detainees, sure, she could have done that. And the record fully explains the many risks that she would have entailed had she gone into the day room.
What does the standard operating procedure say about a sole guard going into the day room under these circumstances?
You know, there is no written policy that prohibits it. It's a common understood practice that single officers working alone...
Is there any testimony in the record that the officers are trained not to go in a room under those circumstances?
There is testimony in the record.
To that effect?
Yes. It's not a written policy, but it's a policy that is taught and understood, because it could lead to potentially dangerous situations regarding increased risks that the officer would face, either himself or herself, should they go in there by themselves in a room full of 70 to 80 detainees. With regard to the Monell claim, Your Honors...
You did say 70 to 80.
I believe the testimony is 70 to 80 detainees.
In the one day...
In that particular tier.
In the day room.
Assigned to that tier. They don't always come out for breakfast every day, but there were 70 to 80 assigned to that tier.
I see. The cell doors open?
Yes. In order for them to eat, they have to pop the doors.
So the prisoners did have access at the time. All of these prisoners did have access at the time to the day room.
Yes, but many choose not to eat at that time of the morning. I'm not saying that there were 70 to 80 on the floor, and that's not what the record suggests either.
I see. Thank you.
With regard to the Monell claim, I would simply submit that counsel has interchanged terminology in terms of art. This is not, and it never has been, a failure to intervene case. It has always been pled as a failure to protect case. The standard is deliberate indifference, although some of the arguments in the reply brief And the cases cited might seem to indicate, refer to it as a failure to intervene. It is not. I believe that it is a deliberate indifference case, and I believe that plaintiff has the burden to show that a custom, practice, or policy is what caused or inflicted the harm to this particular plaintiff. And there's no evidence in this record that a custom, practice, or policy at the jail caused or inflicted any violations of Mr. Guzman's constitutional rights. Further, what plaintiff has actually argued is, in essence, that there was a failure to implement a policy, that being General Order 13.6. In the case that this court came down with last year in Hernandez versus Sheehan, clearly states that operational errors do not support municipal liability, and that units of government can be liable under Section 1983 for unconstitutional policies, not errors in the implementation of those policies. And there is no record. I noticed that the question was asked. There is no evidence in the record that shows that the customs, practices, and policies at the jail regarding reclassification procedures caused harm to anybody, let alone this particular plaintiff. When Mr. Reese was subsequently charged with an upgraded charge of murder, as far as the policies were concerned, he was the same person that was there compared to when he was first processed in Division 5 as medium security. None of the supervisory staff at the jail was put on notice of any kind or made aware that there was a problem, a substantial risk to Mr. Guzman by Reese or by anybody else. The testimony that this court has from all of the parties, from the plaintiff himself, from the tier officer Sandra White, to Sandra White's supervisor Sergeant Hicks, to Hernandez, to Superintendent Brown and Mayweather, they all say that there was no knowledge that this particular inmate was a substantial risk to this plaintiff or anyone else. I see that the light is on, and I would rest in the remainder of my brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groh. Anything further, Mr. Patterson?
In answer to the court's question, there is a specific reference in the briefs and the testimony of the officers that Sandra White was trained to exercise her authority in any incident like this. First thing she does is call 1010 inmates fighting on the radio. Second thing, exercise your authority by giving verbal commands and then wait for backup. We don't claim she should have gone into the day room. There are arguments to be made that that could potentially be dangerous, but she should have exercised
her
authority.
So she did two of the three. She did number one and number three. She didn't do number two. Is that your position?
That's right. She waited. Waited doesn't help stop the fight. But she may not even waited because the evidence is that she left the day room. You should at least stay and be there to show that the badge is there. But
is that does the record show whether this observation venue is on the same level or is she elevated?
No, same level. And there is a photograph in the record looking through the window. To answer Your Honor's question about the reclassification procedures, the court asked, how frequently does this happen? Well, we know for Reese it happened three times on the 60-day cycles. We also know that it didn't happen when his charge was upgraded to murder, and it should have happened. Superintendent Brown said he believed, and of course Lieutenant Mayweather said as well, that they should have reclassified him on any of those several occasions. It never happened. And so our position is that this is recognized and condoned as a custom for the classification procedures. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.